here's Mike Buck and Duke Iona on News Radio 830 KHVH.
Yeah, see, now it's getting easier. Getting easier to hang out with the Lieutenant Governor because of Chris Peters. He just said, hey, why should we look for new music every week? We got Sir Duke right there.
That's it.
Fair enough. You know, that's now you're going to have to learn how to play that on ukulele or something.
Oh, please, no. It's just one.
Okay, listen, we're here for the next hour at 521-8383 to talk story. First thing I want to ask the Lieutenant Governor about is this voting machine because, you know, I asked when we signed this, where was Marion Higa? Where was the auditor? I mean, we made a mistake with this. What's happening with this?
Well, it was subject to litigation. Actually, this was called into question a long time ago, and by the company that lost the bid.
By the
on
one
this.
That lost.
Yeah, they called this into question a long time ago, and it's just gotten around to where it is right now. And so it actually this whole problem started when it was under the leadership of Dwayne Yoshino. And it evolved to where it is right now. So my understanding is that the administrative officer has ruled that the contract is null and void, but it'll stay in existence.
But we still got to use it through this general.
Right. It'll be used. The company that runs the voting machine right now will run it through this election.
Right.
And then come December, they will put it out to bid again for a new voting machine.
Now, let me tell you, one of my listeners commented, and this is a good comment. In the modern day of technology that we are in, nobody should make a commitment that has that many years to it on any technology because it changes so rapidly.
Absolutely. I agree 100% with that. Yeah, that was the first red flag, basically.
Yeah, because then you're stuck with something. You say, well, gee, you mean this other guy's faster, better, quicker, cheaper?
Yeah.
You know, that's what happened.
Yeah, and especially with voting machines because it is an evolving field. And you know, as the Secretary of State, that's one of my official titles as the Secretary of State. A little weird in this state because as the Secretary of State, I have nothing to do with elections. That is totally out of my control. It's not even
attached. The Office of Elections.
Yeah,
it's not attached to your office.
It's not even attached to my office anymore. So, but, you know, traditionally, the Secretary of State, that's what you do. Mm-hmm. You do elections. Mm-hmm. You conduct elections in your state. So I get a lot of information and a lot of communication between various Secretary of States in regards to voting machines and the voting process in general. And I must get, let's go monthly basis. I get at least four or five different mailers from different companies talking about their voting machine and how it's so much more superior than the other person's voting machine.
What we ought to talk about is the evolution of the technology and the machines in general, because one would think that the better you make it, the more people will show up. But what we've got is a declining number of people voting. So I think this year is going to be different. I think there's enough races this year, especially with the presidential race and some others, that we're going to have a spirited election season. But one, there's all kinds of concerns about the machines, the auditing of them, the paper trail or the lack thereof. Now, forget about the money part, but this machine looked like dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's. It was going to do the deal.
Yeah, yeah.
We're just unhappy with the money part.
Well, it was a big issue. There's no question about it. And again, actually, if you were involved with the controversy of this voting machine, one of the biggest issues that they had was exactly what you just talked about, was the credibility of this machine and whether it had, you know, because right now we can vote online. You can go on the machine and you can vote on the machine. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem was it didn't have a paper trail to it. In other words, we couldn't trace the votes that were made on this machine.
Right.
And that was a big issue.
Sure.
And that was a big issue from day one. And it was just kind of completely ignored. I shouldn't say ignored, but it wasn't addressed properly.
Well, that was
another issue.
There are some countries that their elections are a sham. I mean, you know, it doesn't matter if people show up. It's predetermined.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been accusations of that sort of fooling around with election boxes in this country over the last several elections.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking national.
Oh, yeah.
You know, not just, you know, some bad guy in some county rigging the vote, but we're talking about suggestions that whole states were incorrect.
I just got a letter from a secretary.
In Florida, in the last presidential election.
Today, I just got a letter from, I can't recall what state, but basically letting me know what they did in regards to a voter fraud allegation that they had in their state in June. They had their primaries in June.
Mm-hmm.
So they just, she kind of outlined the fraud claim that they had and what they did and how they handled it. And just to kind of give guidance to other secretaries mm-hmm. of state on how to handle, you know, voter fraud allegations and what to do with it. So, yeah, it's happening in America, no doubt about it. And, you know, that's what we want to prevent here in Hawaii. And that's an issue. You know, we're talking about CONCON. We're talking about the Constitutional mm-hmm. Convention. And if you've heard me mention this before, we are the only state, as I just mentioned, where the elections process is not handled by an independent, or I should say an office that is elected by the people.
Mm-hmm.
Every other state, you have a Secretary of State right. that handles elections, and that person is directly responsible to the people. In other words, if they don't do the job right, they get voted out. You
sure.
get somebody else in there,
mm-hmm.
or they can get impeached, or whatever mm-hmm. it may be. In this state, you have an elections officer who is appointed by a board who's actually appointed
mm-hmm.
by the legislators. And
mm-hmm.
they can only be removed by the legislators
right.
and no one else. So you have someone that's totally, I would say, that's not accountable to the people. And so the question becomes, again, this is something that CONCON can take up, is should we have a Secretary of State or at least an elected...
elections officer.
Elections yeah. officer, yeah. exactly.
Elected. You see, here's the thing. One would assume that this happened because it was deemed, hey, this is one way to get it foolproof. We get all of these people agreeing that we're going to narrow down the search and this guy or this gal is going to get it based on qualifications and what the needs are. In a ideal world, that would be a pretty good way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Committee get together, mm-hmm. go through a bunch of names, narrow it down, appoint somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And then just tell them, hey, you know. But they would have the power to remove or replace.
Right. Yeah. Which they do, but yeah. again, they're not held accountable
yeah.
To anybody. And so, and the way it's made up, you have four people who are appointed by the majority party,
mm-hmm.
four people who are appointed by the minority party.
Well, which should even this late there.
right.
That's eight, though. That's eight people.
And then they are supposed to get together and choose the chair. It took them almost 2 years mm-hmm. to choose the chair of
yeah.
this committee. And then they finally did so, and that's how we got the new elections officer.
Right.
It was only until that was done that
okay,
was,
now, right now, that office is in there's controversy in the office regarding the House of Representatives election and city council election.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, according to Kurt Caldwell, he's not going to challenge the ruling by the
right,
elections
right.
office. So that's pretty much done. But, yeah, the Republican Party has filed.
Today they filed the suit.
Exactly.
Saying that that Mr. Choi should not be, that he was a day late.
Right.
You know,
right.
And wouldn't that be a black and white issue? I mean, just here's the calendar. Let's find out.
You would think so, but yeah. if you read the statute on that, and you read the amendments, the constitutional amendments to it, it's not black and white because it doesn't state specifically that the notice that the election officer gets mm-hmm. when somebody withdraws has to be in writing or. If, in other words, an oral notification or a written notification is necessary, it just says notification.
Yeah, but you know what? I tell you something. In a black and white world, if it's not in writing, it doesn't exist. So you can't just say, hey, you know what? Charlie decided not to run. Pull him off the ballot. Hey, wait a minute. I'm not going to do that. Give me something in writing. So I haven't seen the evidence of what day Mr. Caldwell's notice was and Mr. Choi's intent to run was.
Well, it's not so much his intent to run. It all hinges upon when was sufficient.
The papers.
Well,
the
I should
right.
say the fish. You bring up the point. All the statute says that notification, when you receive mm-hmm. notification, that's the operative words, receive notification. So it all boils down to when did the elections office receive notification? Now, you're saying it has to be in writing. And that's what the elections officer is saying. He's saying it has to be in writing. We didn't get writing. Mm-hmm. We didn't get a letter from Caldwell until the 23rd of mm-hmm. July. Well, the Republican Party is saying, no, you had oral notice from his office. In fact, you had the county clerk saying that we received withdrawal notification of his withdrawal on the 22nd. And they emailed that back to the elections mm-hmm. officer. And the elections officer saying, no, that's not good enough. I need to get it from the candidate himself. I didn't get that till the 23rd. That's the operative date. That's the issue right
yeah.
there. That's the issue.
Well, you know, we'll talk about that some more right now. Now, you see, it just goes to show you, in our vast library of music, we can actually do anything. So you too late, brother. Now, listen, one thing that we are going to talk about a little later on is Adjutant General of the State of Hawaii, General Robert Lee, is going to be in the studio. And as you know, Duke, he just got back from the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And we got a bunch of guys deploying. Mm-hmm. And their pre-deployment ceremony is going to be this week. They're going off to the mainland for some updated training. Then they're going back to the war on terrorism.
Right.
So we got this opportunity to do what we in Hawaii do best, and that's hug each other.
That's right.
So you know about this
thing. That's right. Yeah, this is going to be a great opportunity. This Saturday, we're going to send off about 1,700 troops, and as you said, the general will speak more to it. But about 1,700 troops, but the real, besides that, I mean, just going down and saying goodbye to our men and women, we're going to try to break the world's group hug record.
Now, you would think that in Hawaii that would be duck soup. Because, and you know, you open the door right now, everybody's hugging everybody.
Absolutely.
But it's actually, you got to hug the right way.
You
got to
hug it the right way. So, and we need, actually right now, the world record for a group hug is about 6,700 people. And what we want to do is break it good.
I want 20,000.
Yeah, well, we're going to try to get about 10,000 people. Mm-hmm. And the record to be broken, the record, as you said, you need to hold each other a certain way. In other words, it's not like you just lap your arm over somebody's shoulder or you hug them. You know, it's I think it's around the waist and you hold on to the waist. And in addition to that, you need to register everyone who's doing the group hug, and that has to be verified by the Guinness World Book of Records. So it's a little more involved than just having 10,000 people show up, putting their arms around each other and hugging, and we break the record and we count it. No, it's a little more involved, and it's gonna be fun on Saturday. Everyone's welcome to come out. The other catch to this is that we're having a food drive for the Hawaii Food Bank. So part of the admission, bring a canned good, couple of canned goods so we can dump it off for all our people who are in need here in Hawaii for some food.
Okay, now I don't want to take a lot of General Lee's thunder away, because I know that he's going to be pitching us on this too. But I figured that if we can prime the pump
and
get some earlier listeners to get out there and do that.
Absolutely.
So just come out there and learn how to do the group hug.
There you go.
But I'm telling you, you know, we are, we hug here more than any place, I think.
Oh, that's,
you know,
that's,
and I mean, that's just the style.
That's the truth. Know, I mean, you got people who come in from the mainland who just, they get taken aback if you, you know, just kind of shake hands and hug a little. And
okay,
it's not the way it's
now,
done.
You know, I want to return to something. I want to get back to this voting machine thing only because of the money. Because I know that there are some that don't want a con because they're concerned about the money. But when you really take a look at, for instance, I don't think, Lieutenant Governor, that anybody really analyzes what it costs to be the government. I'm not talking about programs and stuff like that. I'm talking about something like an election. Who knows that these things are going to cost $53 million over so many years? I mean, so what we're really talking about in this, and I know that you explained last week, but there was some controversy. A con can be done any number of ways. It's how thrifty do we need to be, or how thorough do we need to be. So what are the ballpark parameters of what it would cost us to do a con?
The drivers for a con are cost drivers. I'm talking about is one, the number of delegates. How many delegates do we need for a constitutional convention? It seems that if we follow the suit of the last constitutional convention, about 100 delegates. The second cost driver then goes as to how much are you going to pay them? What's going to be the rate of compensation?
Right.
And if you pay them the rate of compensation that the legislators get, okay, that'll amount to about $4,000 a month, roughly. If you add on fringe benefits, that's a few hundred thousand dollars more, because the next cost driver is how long is this convention going to be?
That's going to be the number one.
Yeah,
because that's going to determine the quality of delegates, the length of time they're willing to commit. Because if you can get it in and get it out,
right?
And I know that's tough,
right? So, We are, you know, the proposal was anywhere from actually working days itself, mm-hmm. from 60 working days to 90 working days. Yep. In other words, 2 months to 3 months.
Yep.
The overall length of a con can go anywhere from 90 days, because you give 30 days prep time, 30 days pre-prep time and post-prep time. So I will not prep time, but post debriefing time. So you have maybe 120 days total of a constitutional convention. The next cost driver is going to be, where do you hold it?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, right now, the most cost-efficient venue would be the state capitol. Mm-hmm. In other words, just take over when the legislature is done with their session.
Take it over.
Take it over, right? Take over the offices, take over the chambers and, you know, and all the mm-hmm. plenary rooms that we have, the breakout rooms, the meeting rooms that we have, and take over that. And that would be, that'll save you money. The next cost driver is the cost of staff. Mm-hmm. And now we break this down into two different groups of staff. One is the staffers themselves for the delegates,
mm-hmm.
and the others are the staffers for the convention itself. And what we're saying is you can probably save on costs for the convention itself if you use a lot of the government employees
mm-hmm.
from the various departments, and because their salary is already being paid by
and
government.
And they're doing mechanical work.
Exactly. Yeah, you can just bring them in, and mm-hmm. you know, you can save money that way. Now, for the delegates, though, a little different story. And again, what we came up with was a lump sum for each delegate. In other words, giving a delegate $10,000 and saying, here, you got $10,000 for your staff. Use it any way you want to mm-hmm. use it. Now, some may say that's too low. Some may say that's too high. That's a reasonable number.
Now, these numbers just don't come out of thin air.
No.
We've got standards that we can look at.
We looked at the journals mm-hmm. and the reports that we had from the last couple of constitutional mm-hmm. conventions that we had.
30 years ago, though.
Yeah.
You got to do some serious math.
You know, yeah, mm-hmm. but you more or less got an idea of mm-hmm. what they were being paid and, of course, you know, how it was run. And mm-hmm. It may change as far as the process itself, but really it's going to stay about the same. You know, you're going to probably use the same process that you had 30 years ago. The process itself will probably stay the same. Now, the substance is going to change. And one of the other big differences that we have right now is technology.
Yeah, I was going to say, great question off the air. Hasn't technology eliminated the need for as much time as it would have taken in 30 years ago?
I think it was. And, sure. and it's going to, what's really going to make a difference or have a great impact is the education part.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is a mandate. The Constitution says when it's all said and done, we're going to have to educate the public on these amendments mm-hmm. and what they stand for, and so that people can vote. And this is where if you got technology operating from day one in the form of a website, a good
mm-hmm.
website
mm-hmm.
that's very interactive. People can go back and forth with messages, you know, emails, yeah. etc. A lot of the questions, a lot of the concerns that you have up front should be taken care of as this convention is going along.
Yep.
And the delegates can respond, you know, likewise with whoever is concerned with an issue or whatever it may be. So technology should cut down on a lot of time, but more importantly, it should have a great impact on the emphasis or the emphasis and the substance of the amendments that are coming out of this convention.
I can't see it harm. I can only see it help in accuracy, the correct ability to go and get the information. Mm-hmm. For instance, I just found out today that my grandson in school needs to have a minimum of a 2 gigabyte memory stick.
Mm.
I mean, you know what? I mean, we're just naturally now assuming that every kid goes home to a computer.
That's true.
I mean, automatically. And otherwise, what somebody's going to say in the country? Yeah, only wants one memory stick.
That's right.
You know, I mean, what in the heck are we talking about? So we're talking about technology eliminating the need for a lot of paper, a lot of printing,
mm-hmm.
a lot of cost associated mm-hmm. with. Because wasn't one of the complaints, like it is for the ledge, pallet fulls of printing
mm-hmm.
that seemingly sometimes doesn't even get looked at.
Right.
But you got to put it out
right.
there.
And so the drive right now is to go paperless.
Yeah.
And then that's exactly what this CONCON can do. It can set the tone for that. So those are your cost drivers. And when it's all said and done and you add it up and you be as efficient as you can, even though we came up with a high of about $11.1 million for a constitutional convention with 102 delegates, 120 days long, but this was the cost driver that we went above and beyond. We said it would be through leased offices now, not at the Capitol.
Yeah, yeah.
So we didn't factor that in. Mm-hmm. That drove the costs up some. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we said, yes, we'll pay fringe benefits for all staffers and for all delegates. And you know that this is a one-time convention.
Yeah.
It's for a limited time. So fringe benefits should not, in my mind, yeah, what I would say, that? I don't think you should pay them. But,
no, the amount of time is minimal. I think the compensation is important
because
otherwise you're going to not get, somebody's going to say, gee, I'd really like to do that, but I can't afford it. You know?
Right, but fringe benefits are something else. I mean, you're talking about insurance and all that other stuff. But in any case, those are that right there, the venue is what will bring it down, and that's why we estimate that you could get a good constitutional convention for well under $10 million. No question.
And you know, I think that if one question got asked, I mean, when it comes to something important, the kind of things, and we'll review this a little bit, for those of you that don't really understand the types of issues that get decided and looked at in a con, we'll do that. And those of you that have got memory and recall about 1978, 10 years after the name of the group, the song's called Change the World.
That's the rich.
But in this case, Chris said it's more like 30 years after. You know, it's almost not conceivable that we haven't had some sort of an automatic review every decade or whatever. But I guess things have been okay. But now a lot of people realize that a lot of things are changed. There are some people, Lieutenant Governor, that don't really know what a con is for. What's the broad sweep of the brush? And then I know that you have a lot of specifics and I'm not talking about it's being partisan or bipartisan, nonpartisan.
Mm-hmm.
There are some issues that need, because of technology and 30 years, need to be addressed.
The question that's going to be asked on the November ballot is, should we hold a convention to propose amendments to or revision of our Constitution?
Yep.
That's the question. So you have the opportunity to amend and or revise your state constitution. And so from a general perspective, that's exactly what you, the people, will have an opportunity to do, because what you'll do is you'll elect delegates. Your delegates will be your representative.
Mm-hmm.
They'll go and they'll discuss various amendments to the Constitution. And then they will be proposed amendments that will be submitted to the voters.
Right.
And the voters will either ratify or not ratify these amendments. So you see, the process is such that it's not that easy, but it is for the people, and it's by the people, because the people ultimately decide. It's not like, you know, a legislative session in which the legislators
see,
go in.
That's the point that I wanted you to make, that this is not just another branch of legislation that is going to give you more laws. It's going to give you the opportunity to adjust the way laws are interpreted, and that's what the Constitution is. Let's go to Charles up in Red Hills, who's got a comment. Hello, Charles. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike. I've got a comment. I would think that with all the lawyers and the educated muckety-mucks in the legislature, they could write some unambiguous laws. Maybe we ought to have the provision that they be reviewed by high school dropouts before they get into the books.
Well, I'm sorry that you had to spend a lot of time with that kind of a comment, but do you have a real comment, Charles?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, okay. Thanks very much for your call. So, I mean, that's somebody that's got no faith in the legislation.
Yeah.
You know, so, and that, I mean, if that is the case, I mean, who is the checks and balances? I mean, right now we have examples of an auditor and everything else, but now the checks and balances is, if you don't like somebody, vote them out. But we don't have a lot of change, you know. So once again, maybe some because I mean, you know, if you would take like his attitude, which is like, you know, what's the point anyway? Let's talk about some of these specific types of things that might be addressed.
Well, you have these broad categories that we can talk about. For instance, public education. That's a general category that everybody talks about. And this is something that can be looked upon in a constitutional convention with these more specific questions. For instance, do we need a separate charter school board?
Mm-hmm.
Do we need a charter school bill of rights to ensure that they receive adequate funding and resources? As you well know, that's been an issue
from the very beginning of
charter schools, that they're not getting enough. Would smaller local school boards be more responsive to the educational needs of each community? That's another question that can be raised and, of course, discussed at a constitutional convention. Then we can move on to the legislature themselves. I've talked about this quite frequently recently about how our legislature is not subject to sunshine law. So the question could be at a constitutional convention, should the sunshine law apply to the legislature the same way it applies to other state employees and those who serve on boards and commissions?
Sure.
I mean, that's a legitimate question.
Well, I mean, even things like term limits, qualifications of if somebody, in other words, what do you have to be a legislator? Are we too loose?
Exactly.
I mean, you know, are people getting in there that shouldn't be?
How about this one? Does the legislature need to convene every year? That's another question that people have out there. Should we be a bicameral legislature? So, you know, these are questions that are, again, specific questions in relation to this broad topic about the legislature itself.
There are a lot of people that ask themselves the question every year. When looking at the end of the legislative session, do you mean to say that these guys are writing a law about that? What's that? Is that just to keep busy?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Let's go to Don on the phone. Hello, Don. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon.
A couple of things I'd like to suggest. Maybe a little bit more opportunity to protect ourselves against criminals.
Absolutely.
For honest citizens. And there's some sunset commission for various departments and commissions that, you know, they have to go out of business without state, you know, recertification.
Yeah, I think there's any number of inside stuff. But what I want to know is, and Don, that's a great question, how would that even be approached as an issue to begin with? In other words, what Don is saying is, and Don, I'm going to have Lieutenant Governor answer that for you, how an issue becomes something discussed at a CONCON?
Through the delegates,
right.
In other words, that you. So the first question, again, as I just mentioned, is going to be: should we have a convention to propose amendments to or revisions of our Constitution? You say yes. Once that's decided, and once you say yes, now our legislature will have to determine: okay, how many delegates are we going to have for a constitutional convention? Where is it going to be held, and how much are they going to be compensated? What's the budget going to be for this convention?
And by the way, it's not the same old, same old. The legislators don't just all of a sudden become CONCON delegates.
No, not at all. And so let's just say it's 100 delegates. Okay, they will then determine how are they going to be elected and when are they going to be elected. So now we have an election to elect these delegates. And again, I can't emphasize this enough. At the last, you know, because the rap's going to be, well, you know, why are we going to have one when it's going to be the same people who are now our legislators are going to be the delegates for this constitution? At the last constitutional convention, we had 102 delegates. Only six delegates were actually legislators.
Yeah, lawmakers.
Yeah, only
so
six.
So, Don, oops, he's gone. So I was going to say, I hope that sort of the delegate is going to feel, gee, you know, well, what would be important to me?
Absolutely.
And hopefully with 100 of them. You get enough.
And that's why we say this is a grassroots type of initiative, because now you're going to have to get involved. You want your issues to be discussed. That Don just talked about crime and some of the Bill of Rights that maybe victims might need. Well, then you go run and let's get you elected to be a delegate so you can bring this up and talk about it.
We'll take as many calls as we can. Let's go next to Bob on the cell. Hey, Bob.
Actually, I apologize. I got into your show late, but I know last convention, I don't know if it was a gentleman's agreement or what, where the legislators said they would not run, you know. So my concern is there any way that can be put into the situation so we don't get actual legislators running for these?
That's a great point.
Or even people who work, you know, with them.
Yeah.
I want citizen, the average guy, not a legislator, somebody works in his office. Or that kind of stuff. And I don't know how it worked the last time.
That's good. And Lieutenant Governor was just showing that there were six.
Six.
But we don't know how many others might have been staffers or relatives, or maybe that can be defined.
Yeah, there were staffers. I mean, there were people who were on staffs of some legislators who ran and won and got elected. But I don't believe it was that many. I mean, we had our rising stars from this. If you recall, Bill Patey was the chairperson of this.
Yeah.
He was part of I think he might have been a director of some department.
And look at his years of service after that.
And other other people roles to become future leaders of the state of Hawaii. But I'm not sure if we could pass legislation that would say, I'm sure we can pass legislation that would say that no, legislators are not eligible. But right now, it seems that everyone would be eligible to be a candidate. Well, above, I think you got to be above 18. You have to be a resident of the state of Hawaii.
I think that a lot of voters would hesitate, even if they liked a legislator, to elect them to that group, because they're saying, isn't what we want a fresh look at this?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Jim on a cell phone. Hey, Jim.
Hi. You know, one of the things I'm interested in at ConCon is the referendum, is that people be given a referendum right. And also the fact that the committee chairman can go ahead and kill a bill. I know that that's a legislative rules thing, but at least a referendum would get around that. When they kept killing a bill that the public wanted, we could at least have a referendum put
yeah,
it on.
Amen to that. I think that one is one that really shouts clearly.
You bring out a good point, Jim, but let me just kind of comment on this. In the 1978 Constitutional Convention, that was one of the number one amendments that was proposed. Initiative and referendum.
And it never made it.
Yeah, now, for whatever reason, it could have been because there was a more concentration or more intensity for Native Hawaiian rights at that convention. But needless to say, that was one of the top amendments, and it never made it. So,
Well, I think that the people's experience of the legislature in the past 15, 20 years has brought it to the forefront.
And that's exactly why we're saying why we need a constitutional convention at this point in time.
Hey, Jim, thanks for your call. We got another one. This is in Waikiki on another cell. Another Jim. Hey, Jim.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
My question or concern is about strategizing so we don't end up electing the same people to not change anything. And I think the Republican Party, who definitely isn't in the side with the people that are in power, except for the governor and lieutenant governor, maybe should start training people on how you be a delegate, how do you run for this thing, so people will feel comfortable.
Yeah, it won't be automatic.
And they'll vote yes. And
that's
they'll
right.
vote yes, because it's not that hard. It just sounds like some awful thing.
Well, I think that somebody is more likely to be part of a con than run for office. Because somebody might come out of the business or educational or recreational community and say, I want to put my 5 cents in, but I don't want to do it for a living.
Yeah,
I think people have to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most people have to go to work, so they're not even going to consider it. And it's not that difficult. They need to understand the nuts and bolts of what happens there and how you run a campaign for that kind of office.
Yeah.
Because it's not the same sign-waving thing with as many family and friends as you can get.
Exactly.
I actually ran in 78 very unsuccessfully.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And I was very disappointed because I actually got beat by Akira Sakima, who had been the legislator for my area.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the six.
One of the six
legislators that got elected, yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, and then John Waihei and his group went from ConCon to control the state.
So it's really important. Yep.
Yeah, you're right about that, and then that's why I am out there on a daily basis, speaking to all different types of civic groups and organizations. Just pleading with them to please get involved in this process, because it really is a powerful process, and it's something that really, when you talk about democracy, I don't know what better way to define democracy than through a constitutional convention. And you're right, it can't be about name recognition. It is a little different run for an office, if that's what you want to call it, but I don't look at it as running for an office. I look at it as fulfilling a civic obligation, and I've drawn this analogy. I think it's very close to jury service, really is.
I think so too. I was going to almost liken that to that. So thanks very much for your call, Jim. Okay, don't forget, when LG and I are done, General Robert Lee's in the house. We're going to talk about, among other things, about a deployment and about a fun event coming up at the stadium. But right now, give the people what they want. See, Chris Peters, he loves it.
He's got this down.
Yeah, let's get back to the telephones. They're all lit up. Sue and Kaimaki, you waited the longest. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. I was here for the last ConCon, And Lieutenant Governor was right when he said that's where John Waihe'e got his start, in that group. And it is a place where people aspiring for political office do get name recognition and get their ideas put forth. And it also was the place where Native Hawaiian rights were addressed, ceded lands, and OHA was established. So it's a very serious thing, and I agree with the Lieutenant Governor. You know, we've got to cast a wide net for the ConCon.
Yeah, I think that's really a good point, because we have a lot of issues that, even though they got off the ground back then, 30 years ago, they're still not resolved.
Oh, absolutely. Right? Thank you. Yeah, those are great comments. Exactly right. And, you know, putting out some other things, we've talked about it. We've talked about, you know, our elections office and where we should go with that. How about this one? We, you know, right now we got a little controversy on unions and, you know, and employees. And, you know, one of the questions that we should bring up is, what should we do with our civil service system? Is the collective bargaining laws that we have, are they fair and just right now? These are things that we can talk about, and we can actually put on a ballot come November of maybe 2010. Yep. when we vote on these amendments.
Okay, Sue, thanks very much. Let's go from Kaimuki to Waikiki, and Ed is next. Hello, Ed.
Yeah, Lieutenant Governor, you mentioned people being qualified to be a delegate to ConCon, and one key word you mentioned, being a resident. What qualifies as a resident? Could Duke Bainham qualify to run for ConCon as a resident? And how does he qualify if he left the state 4 years ago?
That's a good question, and that's something that's subject to interpretation by the elections office, and they determine whether or not you are qualified as a resident of the state of Hawaii. But that's the language. I'm not making that up. That's the language that's in the statute in regards to qualifications as to a resident.
Yeah, and Ed, I sort of pointed that out the last time, or the last couple times you've talked about that, rightfully so. But my point was then, and still is now, that if Duke Bainham was not qualified to run for that office, it's not his fault that he was accepted. It's whoever accepted him. Is that correct?
No.
Yes, it is, Ed. Yes, it is. If he met the requirements, according to the person examining him, then he met the requirements. You're saying that he didn't. I don't know that he didn't.
I don't either.
Okay, well, thanks very much, because that makes it moot.
You have to be a taxpayer.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I'm sure that you can't get out of that. You know, if you have to be a taxpayer, show a residence. So, some people that have a lot of money, they can show a residence wherever they want.
You got people who pay taxes to the state of Hawaii who reside maybe 7 months out of the year, or, you know, even more in some other state.
Okay, let's go to Gary in Hawaii Kai next. Hello, Gary.
Hi.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Lieutenant Governor.
Hi, how you doing?
I have three questions. First question is, how do you run for the ConCon? The second question is, why do we even need a state-controlled education system? Most of the other states don't have it. And the third question is it possible that we can get a right-to-work clause into the Constitution like almost 90% of the other states have?
Boy, those are like three questions that could go 8 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, in the time that we have remaining, let's tackle the first one. Would you repeat the first one, Gary?
The first question was, how do you run for the ConCon?
Okay.
It'd be like any other election. Once the determination has been made that you will have a convention, the legislators, like I said, will determine when and how the delegates would be elected. In other words, through a special election or at a general election. And it probably would be through a special election. So you'd probably have, if the voters in November of this year said, yes, we wanted a constitutional convention, then you'd probably have a special election sometime in 2009.
In 2009.
Right.
And then wouldn't the ConCon convene in 2010?
Right, before the general election in 2010. And so
there's you know, just for time expediency, that would be the first one. The next question, Gary, you asked about was, our state being different from others with regards to the educational system.
Yes, could the voters decide to have not a state-run education system anymore and have it a county-based or a neighborhood-based school system?
Absolutely. That's something that that a constitutional convention can address. No doubt about it.
And then the last was that could there be a clause in the Constitution to make us a right-to-work state?
Yes.
Where companies wouldn't be affected by unions anymore?
Yes.
Okay, now, that being said, and Ed, thanks, I mean, Gary, thanks very much for your questions. Let's talk about some things that may be obvious to some. Oh, yeah, we ought to have that. Let's take a look at referendum the last time.
Mm-hmm.
Because as many people as want referendum today, 30 years ago, it got hammered. I mean, it wasn't even close.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
So when you talk right to work, doesn't that mean that every union would be out campaigning? Saying, hey, you guys vote for that, you're going to lose your strength. You're going to lose your bargaining. You're going to lose your ability to negotiate.
And that's the argument that's being made by the opponents of a constitutional convention. They're saying that you're going to lose these rights. You're going to lose civil rights. You're going to lose labor employee rights, et cetera, et cetera. And my response to that is real simple. A lot of these issues cut both ways. In other words, it'll be beneficial to some, it'll be detrimental to others. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line, again, is it's about the people. And the people will decide that ultimately, again, as we were pointing out earlier, unlike a legislative session, the people will determine whether or not an amendment will be adopted. Mm-hmm. Not the legislators, not a chair committee, not a chairman of a committee, nor a committee of Democrats. It'll be the people who will determine whether or not these amendments will pass or not pass. The law, the Constitution specifically says that any amendment that comes out of a convention mm-hmm. needs to be voted upon individually. In other words, everyone needs to have an opportunity to vote yes
exactly.
or no for
words,
that amendment.
Yeah, exactly. In other words, there's a lot of people that say, okay, there were a number of things talked about at this CONCON. Do you vote yes or no?
Yes.
You've got to vote on every
yes,
one of them.
Every single one of
which
them.
Which actually means that those that really want to get involved can be made to make a difference. There's even the question that I got asked a lot last week after you left was, okay, what about this thing when you vote for something, yes means yes, no means no, no vote means what the heck does it mean, yes today, no tomorrow, a no vote's a yes vote, what the heck's that all about?
That's only in regards to the first question, which is
right.
whether or not we will have a constitutional convention. Unfortunately, our Supreme Court ruled that a yes is yes, a no is no, and a blank means no. For that question only.
Yeah.
Just for that question. Not for the amendments, but for that question only.
I cannot understand that for the life of me. I cannot understand.
That's the ruling.
Okay, LG. Now, Saturday, group hug.
Yes.
Don't forget now.
Yes, Aloha Stadium.
Yeah, okay.